Welcome to Life and Death, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of the show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. The show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are its traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's very useful to have some notebook, paper, and pen during the show. And I will commence right away with our study of the web of debt. Just by way of my weekly overview, our money system is not what we have been led to believe. The creation of money has been privatized or taken over by a private money cartel. Except for coins, all of our money is now created as loans advanced by private banking institutions, including the private Federal Reserve. Banks create the principal, but not the interest to service their loans. To find the interest, new loans must continually be taken out, expanding the money supply, inflating prices, and robbing you of the value of your money. And we've been studying from a book called The Web of Debt by Ellen Brown. And this book, and hopefully these shows, are geared towards unraveling the deception regarding money and presenting a crystal clear picture of the financial abyss towards which we are headed. But over time, we will also be exploring workable alternatives, particularly one that was tested in colonial America and is grounded in the best of American economic thought, including the writings of Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and Abraham Lincoln. Our goal is to analyze the concept of financial security, our own and our nation's, and find practical ways to navigate out of the incredible maze in which we find ourselves financially. I'd like to begin with an important credit because the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in this program are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of attorney, scholar, and author Ellen Brown, who has over 11 books and scores of articles. I highly recommend her book, which we are using as the textbook, The Web of Debt, and her website by the same name. And you can also revisit all the shows I've done in this series at the archives, www.kruufm.com under Life and Debt. And specifically with respect to this series of shows, Life and Debt Web. Now, just to recap a little bit, last time we spoke, I was at the stage of the American Revolution and the monetary system at that time, and how it was very much different from what we have today. The colonies were using what was known as colonial scrip. The government of the provinces, Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, and others, were making their own money and distributing it for the benefit of the people based on products and services. It was not a banking-based system like we have today, where governments, be they states or the federal government, is borrowing money from a private bank, and then we are paying back the loan plus a large amount of interest, which is charged against the loan, a concept which frankly goes against the idea of the government being in charge of the finances. Well, the colonies were doing this, and that means they were making their own money, and soon discovered they really didn't need England with its gold and silver to influence the monetary system. Many of the provinces were prospering quite well under the system. That is, of course, until England got back involved and British merchants and financiers who were doing business with the colonies started leaning on the Parliament to prohibit the practice of the colonies making their own money. In 1751, King George II enacted a ban on the issue of new paper money in the New England colonies. At that time, existing issues, however, money that was already out there in circulation, could still be renewed. And this ban was continued under King George III, who succeeded his father in about 1760. In 1764, Benjamin Franklin went to London to petition Parliament to lift the ban. He completely extolled the benefits of colonial scrip to the citizens of Pennsylvania, where he was from, and he assured his listeners in England that New York and New Jersey have also increased greatly during the same period with the use of paper money, so that it does not appear to be the ruinous nature ascribed to it. Now, this was basically a catch-22 kind of argument, very tricky. Colonists had been stressing to the mother country how poor they were, so poor they were forced to print paper money for lack of precious metals. Yet, Franklin's report demonstrated to Parliament and the British bankers, the real culprits behind the whole thing, that the pretext for allowing paper money had been removed. The point of not existing as colonies to benefit themselves, but the motherland providing raw materials and decent rates to the mother country, was in high relief here. You see that giving the government the benefit of money creation was a complete reversal of the British school of economics, in which the government had to borrow from private bankers at interest. And Franklin's appeal was viciously opposed by banking interests, which is really under the same rubric as too big to fail today. We're very much in the same position that the British government had over the colonies back then. We, meaning collectively the U.S. government and the banks to which the U.S. government is indebted. Well, back to Franklin. Instead of lifting the ban when he, in his most articulate way, pointed out the value of the paper money system, Parliament wound up passing a Currency Act that was even stricter than the earlier prohibition. Such is the story of dealing with politicians. It banned not only the issue of any new bills, but the reissue of existing currency, which was allowed under the former law. The bill declared that no act, order, resolution, or vote of assembly in any of His Majesty's colonies or plantations in America shall be made for creating or issuing any paper bills or bills of credit of any kind or denomination whatsoever, declaring such paper bills or bills of credit to be legal tender. And the result of that was the colonists were forced to pay all future taxes to Britain in silver or gold, or in Bank of England banknotes, supposedly backed by those precious metals. Since we didn't have any gold or silver mines in the colonies at that point, this meant that the colonies had to go into debt to the British bankers. And I will return to this topic in a moment. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Now, in response to this state of affairs, Alexander Hamilton, who was the first U.S. Secretary of the Treasury, said that paper money had composed 3/4 of the total money supply before the American Revolution. When the colonists could not issue their own currency, the money supply suddenly shrank, leaving what? Widespread unemployment, hunger, poverty, etc., in its wake. Finally, in response to that, the oppressed colonists ignored the ban and went back to issuing their own paper money. The historian Alexander Del Mar wrote in 1895, and this is a quote, "The creation and circulation of bills of credit by revolutionary assemblies, coming as they did upon the heels of the strenuous efforts by the Crown to suppress paper money in America, were acts of defiance so contemptuous and insulting to the Crown that forgiveness was therefore impossible. There was but one course for the Crown to pursue, and that was to suppress and punish these acts of rebellion." His conclusion was this: "Thus the bills of credit of this era, which ignorance and prejudice have attempted to belittle into the mere instruments of a reckless financial policy, were really the standards of the revolution. They were more than this. They were the revolution itself." And that's the end of the quote. This was later echoed by Peter Cooper, founder of Cooper Union College and a former colleague of Treasury Secretary Albert Gallatin. Cooper wrote in his 1883 book, quote, "After Franklin had explained to the British government as to the real cause of prosperity, they immediately passed laws forbidding the payment of taxes in that money. This produced such great inconvenience and misery to the people that it was the principal cause of the revolution. A far greater reason for a general uprising than the Tea and Stamp Act was the taking away of paper money." And there's a final corroboration that's an important one because it was confirmed by historian Charles Bullock, who is a particularly credible source because he was not actually in favor of paper money. He advocated a return to specie, which was precious metal coinage, and wrote in 1900, quote, "There can be little doubt that the acts of 1751 and 1764, which suppressed further issues of bills of credit, contributed not a little to the final breach with the mother country. In 1776, when he was examined before the House of Commons, Franklin gave it as his deliberate opinion that one reason for the impatience and disrespect which the colonies were manifesting toward the parliamentary authority was the prohibition of making paper money. Too little attention has been given to this fact by most historians. In colony after colony, party lines came to be drawn upon this sole issue." And again, that was a quote from the historian Charles Bullock. But where did this leave the colonists? They suddenly found themselves at war and without the means to pay for it. The first act of the new Continental Congress was to issue its own paper scrip, popularly called the Continental. Most of the Continentals were issued as IOUs, or debts of the revolutionary government, to be redeemed in coinage later. Eventually, $200 million in Continental scrip were issued. By the end of the war, however, the scrip had been devalued so much that it was essentially worthless, but it still evoked the wonder and admiration of foreign observers because it allowed the colonists to do something that had never been done before in modern known history. They succeeded in financing a war against a major power with virtually no hard currency of their own, and they did it without taxing the people. Talk about heaven. No taxes. Benjamin Franklin wrote from England during the war that the whole is a mystery even to the politicians how we can pay with paper that had no previously fixed fund appropriated specifically to redeem it. This currency as we manage it is a wonderful machine. That's Franklin. Thomas Paine called it the cornerstone of the revolution. Every stone in the bridge that has carried us over seems to have claim upon our esteem. But this was a cornerstone, and its usefulness cannot be forgotten. It's too bad that we have forgotten it here in our country. The Continental's usefulness was forgotten, with a little help from the motherland, that being England back then. So what happened? Well, the British engaged in a form of economic warfare that could be used again by the bankers in the 19th century against Abraham Lincoln, which did happen, and the greenbacks, and in the 20th century against a variety of other currencies. And that is this. They attacked their competitor's currency and drove down its value. This still happens today globally. In the 1770s, when paper money was easy to duplicate, its value could be diluted by physically flooding the market with counterfeit money. In modern times, as we will discuss later, the same effect is achieved by another form of counterfeiting known as the short sale. During the American Revolution, the scrip continentals were shipped in by the boatload and could be purchased in any amount, essentially for the cost of the paper that they were printed on. Counterfeiting extraordinaire. Thomas Jefferson estimated that counterfeiting added $200 million to the money supply, effectively doubling it, and later historians thought this figure was probably low. A 19th century historian, J.W. Shuckers, wrote, "The English government, which seems to have a mania for counterfeiting the paper money of its enemies, entered into competition with private criminals." Well, obviously, the continental scrip was battered. However, it still remained viable. Shuckers quoted a confidential letter from an English general to his superior stating that, quote, "The experiments suggested by your lordships have been tried. No assistance that could be drawn from the power of gold or the arts of counterfeiting have been left untried. But still, the currency has not failed," end quote. So we're seeing here a fascinating reality coming up. When money is actually printed and linked to the production and the services, as was the continental scrip, a new paradigm is actually created and it's very successful. And it remained somewhat alive, even though there was this counterfeiting going on, which usually inflates the money and eventually devalues it to a pathetic amount. But then we have one other element, speculators. Once again, this is the American Revolution, but the principle has not changed today. The beating down that did come to the Continental was from speculators, mostly Northeastern bankers, stockbrokers, and businessmen, who bought up the scrip at a fraction of its value after convincing people it would be worthless after the war. The Continental had to compete with other currencies, making it vulnerable to speculative attack, just as foreign currencies left to, quote, float in international markets are today, and we'll get into this in depth down the road. So the Continental scrip had to compete with the state's paper notes and the British bankers' gold and silver coins. Gold and silver were regarded as far more valuable than the paper money, which are promises of a revolutionary government that might not prevail, and the state's paper notes had the taxation power to back them. So that was the challenge to the Continental. Now, that problem could have been avoided by making the Continental the sole official currency, but the Continental Congress did not yet have the power to enforce that sort of order among all of the colonies. It had no courts, no police, and no authority to collect taxes to redeem the notes or contract the money supply. The colonies had just rebelled against taxation by the British and were not ready to commit to that burden from the new Congress. Speculators took great advantage of these weaknesses by buying up Continentals at a deeper and deeper discount until they became virtually worthless, giving rise to the expression, "not worth a Continental." And I'll return in a second. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Now I'll continue with another quirk in the whole history here, how the government was persuaded to borrow its own money. And for those of you who are new to the show, there's a parallel here in all of this historical scenario with the wonderful Wizard of Oz, and how, in fact, that was an allegory about the financial condition of the United States in the late 1800s and the turn of the century there. And of course, the book itself is real to the economic plight, whereas the movie spun off in some other directions. But what we're looking at here, by way of a parallel, is this. The witch happened to look into the child's eyes and saw how simple the soul behind them was, and that the little girl did not know of the wonderful power the silver shoes gave her. So the wicked witch laughed to herself and thought, "I can still make her my slave, for she does not know how to use her power." And that's a quote from the book. And in the book, it was silver shoes, not the ruby slippers. The silver really representing the use of silver to back money or silver coins themselves, which was an important issue during the farming and industrial crisis at the end of the 1800s. But what was happening now? Just as Dorothy did not know the power of the silver shoes on her feet, the new country's leaders failed to recognize the power of the government-issued paper money Thomas Paine had called a cornerstone of the revolution. The economic subservience King George could not achieve by force was achieved by the British bankers by stealth, by persuading the American people that they needed the bankers' paper money instead of their own. President John Adams is quoted as saying, "There are two ways to conquer and enslave a nation. One is by sword, the other is by debt." Professor Brown points out that conquest by the sword has the disadvantage that the conquered are likely to rebel. Continual force is required to keep them at bay. Conquest by debt can occur so silently and insidiously that the conquered don't even realize that they have new masters. On the surface, nothing has changed. The country is merely under new management. Tribute is collected in the form of debts and taxes, which the people believe they are paying for their own good. Their captors become their benefactors and protectors. Without realizing it, they are conquered, and the instruments of their own society are used to transfer their wealth to the captors and make the conquest complete. Well, just looking a little bit at the concept of a colony, colonies in the 17th and 18th centuries all had the same purpose. And what was that? To enhance the economy of the mother country. Probably coinage of a wrong term. That's like no mother should ever be. In this regard, they were being very bold and forward thinking. Well, the British had considered the idea of a land bank as far back as 1754 as a way to provide a circulating medium of exchange for the colonies. But the idea was rejected by the colonists when they learned that the interest the bank generated would be subject to appropriation by the king. It was only after the American Revolution that British bankers and, of course, their Wall Street vassals succeeded in pulling this feat off by stealth, by acquiring a controlling interest in the stock of the United States Bank. The very first step in that silent conquest was to discredit the paper scrip issued by the revolutionary government and the states. The concept of spin goes way back. People believe what they hear through the media. By the end of the revolution, that step had actually been achieved. Rampant counterfeiting and speculation had so thoroughly collapsed the value of the Continental that the new country's leaders were completely disillusioned with what they called unfunded paper. at the Constitutional Convention, Alexander Hamilton, Washington's new Secretary of the Treasury, summed up the majority view when he said, quote, "To emit an unfunded paper as the sign of value ought not to continue a formal part of the Constitution, nor even hereafter to be employed, being in its nature repugnant with abuses and liable to be made the engine of imposition and fraud." The writer Ellen Brown concludes the Founding Fathers were so disillusioned with paper money that they simply omitted it from the Constitution. Congress was given the power only to coin money, regulate the value thereof, and to borrow money on the credit of the United States. Well, that's an enormous loophole being left in the law. Creating and issuing money had long been considered the prerogative of governments, but the Constitution failed to define exactly what money was. Was to coin money an 18th century way of saying to create money? Did this include creating paper money? If not, who did have the power to create paper money? Congress was authorized to borrow money, but did that include borrowing money made of paper or just gold? The presumption was that the paper notes borrowed from the bankers were, quote, secured by a sum of silver or gold. But in the illusory world of finance, then, as now, things were not always as they seemed. So this leads to the fact that the bankers' paper money comes in through the back door. While the Founding Fathers were pledging their faith in gold and silver as the only sound money, those metals were quickly proving inadequate to fund the new country's expanding economy. The national war debt had reached $42 million with no silver or gold coins available to pay it off. The debt might have been avoided if the government had funded the war with continental scrip that was stamped legal tender, making it money in itself. But the revolutionary government and the states had issued much of their paper money as promissory notes payable after the war. Completely different setup. The notes represented a debt, and the debt had now become due. The bearers expected to get their gold, and the gold was not to be had. There was also an insufficient supply of money for conducting trade. Tightening the money supply by limiting it to coins had quickly precipitated another depression. In 1786, a farmers' rebellion broke out in Massachusetts, led by Daniel Shays. Farmers brandishing pitchforks complained of going heavily into debt when paper money was plentiful. When it was no longer available and debts had to be repaid in the much scarcer hard coin of the British bankers, some farmers lost their farms. The rebellion was diffused, but visions of anarchy solidified the sense of an urgent need for both a strong central government and an expandable money supply. Well, what was the solution? The solution of the Treasury Secretary Hamilton was to monetize national debt. And to monetize means to convert government debt from securities evidencing debt, bills, bonds, and notes into currency that can be used to purchase goods and services. Hamilton proposed that a national bank be authorized to print up banknotes and swap them for the government bonds. The government would pay regular interest on the debt using import duties and money from the sale of public land. So that was a positive solution, and we will continue next week. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, please call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt-manageable life.